Blog Talk Radio.
Some of the guests on this podcast will express their viewpoints based on their own research, and those views aren't necessarily those of Blog Talk Radio, Cursed Net, Breakthrough Radio, or its affiliates. This podcast will also be available on iTunes under the keyword Cursed Net.
Hello, everyone. My name is Byron LeBeau, and welcome to Cursed Net Breakthrough Radio. Today is Sunday, November the 8th, 2009. And we are going to have a special roundtable discussion with a lady from California by the name of Sheila Broughton, who will be explaining to us the details of her experiences with entities from elsewhere. And joining me will be our own Greg Messina, as well as a previous guest by the name of Zen Garcia, who also was a co-host on Truth Seekers of the Matrix. And incidentally, it was the same Blog Talk Radio program where I first became aware of Sheila's extraordinary testimony being interviewed back in June by both Georgia Johnson and her sister, Kanoi. Well, before I bring on Greg and Zen, I have three comments. The first one concerns a person who called into our October 19th podcast. It was entitled Zeitgeist, and was curious about an observation I had made about the lack of autism among the Amish who do not vaccinate their children. Now, if you go to my website, inspectorblebeau.pbwiki.com, and scroll down on the left to the October 21st post, you will find a link to Dr. Joseph Merkola, who actually confirms the truth of this particular dynamic. The guest at the time was curious about what I was saying and wanted to know if I had any confirmation, and I didn't at the time, but I had heard of this particular situation, and so I thought it was my duty to actually see if I could find a confirming link by a doctor, which I did. So that's why I'm prompting you to go to the October 21st post, because the subject is so vital to an understanding about vaccines and how they may be linked to autism. So you can use your own judgment as far as that goes. Now, secondly, on the October 29th post, I put a link to Gary Knoll's 25-minute testimonial hearing that clearly demonstrates the dangers of vaccines and the insight into certain pharmaceutical companies. I was very touched by Gary Knoll. One of my best friends has done in-depth study of Gary Knoll, and I was very aware of him as a homeopathic alternative doctor. He really knows what he's talking about, ladies and gentlemen, and if you go to this post and listen to this 25-minute testimonial, you'll actually see a woman in the background crying. That's how powerful his testimony is. So I definitely enjoin you to do that. Well, lastly, for the listeners who already suspect that evolutionists are weaving an evil anti-biblical web throughout society, particularly through our institutions of higher learning, and wish to see how the scam works in detail, I invite you to read orthodontist Jack Kuzo's book called Buried Alive, which I just finished, for these particular details, as he takes a bite out of the understanding the truth behind Neanderthal man and what the powers that be in France do not want you to know and what lengths they are willing to go to prevent what Dr. Kuzo was uncovering and also to protect their own interest in this particular matter. It's technically a very good and insightful read. And I bring these particular books up, ladies and gentlemen, simply because, as you know, as far as I'm concerned, one of the underpinnings of not really fully grasping the truth of the Bible is a belief in evolution. And we see we're being bombarded with it throughout our whole society. Every time you turn on the television and they have a reference to it, it's almost like they take it so much for granted that the alternatives are just brushed to the side, pretty much like what they do with the vaccine situation. So I kind of see both of these things in the same light of you really need to do your own research so that we find out what really is going on. Well, now, joining me tonight for our discussion with our guest Sheila are both Greg Messina, our producer, and Zen Garcia. Greg, can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear, Byron. Thank you for coming on. And Zen, thank you also for coming on with us. I appreciate it.
Right. Thanks for inviting me, fellas. I really appreciate it myself.
Okay, great. Well, as this is going to be kind of an informal round, to when I say round table, I'll pretty much be handling the questioning simply because I spent so much time with Sheila and trying to get to the bottom of this really intriguing story that she has. But before we start, would either Greg or Zen, would either of you care to make any particular introductory statement or a comment about today's guest?
I'd like to make a comment about the three stories that you just introduced about the vaccines, just to give a little bit more detail or more research for the people out there, the listening audience. There's a series of articles written by a guy named Dan Olmsted. He writes for United Press International, and he did a series of studies and journal pieces where he researched that one particular point, the Amish community and the lack of autism as far as within those communities, and how the Amish communities, they don't vaccinate their children. Another community of people that are similar to the Amish is the Nation of Islam. They also do not vaccinate their children, and autism is also not a hindrance for their community. So those are two things that they can check out as far as all of that.
Right. And Zen, is Dan Olmsted, is he a doctor or a journalist?
He is a journalist, but he gets his research and information from doctors that actually treat and take care of the Amish communities. And the Amish are very particular. They don't go to just any particular doctor. And the particular doctors that he got his statistics and his research from are those doctors that are entrusted by the Amish community to take care of their children.
Gotcha. Okay, well, that's a good secondary confirmation, since the person that actually went there that I'm familiar with, Dr. Merkula, really did confirm what we were suggesting on that particular program that we had not too long ago. And now, Zen, did you have any other comments about any of my other remarks or whatever?
No, but as far as with Sheila, I've been familiar with Sheila's story for quite a number of months now. She's been she joined fallenangels.tv quite a while ago. It's been several months, I know, and I've done shows. Kevin and I did a show where we had Sheila on, and we did a whole 2 hours, and 1 hour, I know, complete about her story. So I'm very intrigued into where this is going to go, and her experience and her the whole scenario that was set up around her life and how it all evolved to her knowledge and utilizing the fact that Yahushua is Savior Messiah and invoking his name and calling him for protection can indeed banish these demonic presences. And so, and that's something that you guys have been on the forefront of for quite a long time now, and praise God, because I feel for those souls out there in the world that are so lost as to have nobody to speak to, nobody to go to for answers, and have no idea as to what direction to, and where to go next.
Right.
And so,
As a matter of fact, Zen, in my own discussions with Sheila has something very positive to say along those lines, which we'll get to by the end of the podcast. So
Right, right.
Thank you for your remarks. And also, I just want to make an announcement to the listening audience that Zen's mother recently did pass away. And I would just like you to be aware of that and perhaps to keep her in your own prayers. I know your mother is probably the closest, literally, figuratively, whatever way you want to look at it, the closest person that you'll ever be connected with from beginning to end. And when you lose somebody like that, it's just like, it must be just devastating. I'm caring for my mother right now, and I just, my heart goes out for you, Zen. And the very fact that you're here under this tremendous strain that you're through, I really say hats off to you, because I know how difficult it would be psychologically to deal with that and also to try to do a radio program at the same time. So I just
My prayers go out to your family as well. Sorry to interrupt you there, Byron, but I thank you again tremendously for coming on with us today and to discuss this interview. And I just want to say a couple things regarding Sheila's testimony. It very, you know, it intrigued me, you know, especially understanding the stuff that she's gone through, because I've only gone through, I would have to say, not even an eighth of what she's been through. But it's certainly intriguing to me, and something that has sparked just this overwhelming sense of understanding and stuff that I can relate to. But again, I mean, I know so many other people have been through things that I could not even imagine going through, and but the Lord is gracious in all his ways and has brought her through it. And she's here today to be able to speak out against the evil forces. And this is wonderful to have people come out and share their testimonies with us. And, you know, it reminds me of a passage in Scripture, Revelation 12:11. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. And I'm just so grateful for people like Sheila to be able to come on and share.
Right. Well, and thank you very much, Greg. It's delightful that the things that we try to grapple with here on the Cursing Head Breakthrough Radio can be scripturally linked to. And I especially like when you make your comment, it always seems to have a scriptural backup to it. And it's so important when we're dealing with things like this, because there are so many people out there who right now, as I speak, don't even consider this as a possibility of the things that we're discussing.
Right.
And I feel sorry for them. I really do, because of what I know and the time I've spent and the experiences I've had. So all I can say is, if you know somebody out there and you've been touched by anything on these broadcasts that we've had, please let these people know that there is an alternative. There is. It's not hopeless. People who think that when they come into the grips of the dark side, that's the end, or they're worse, they're spun into a belief that there's some extraterrestrials from the galaxies far, far away. Well, nothing could be further than the truth. And having said that, I think we spent long enough time. We must bring on now Sheila from California. Sheila, can you hear me?
Yes, uh-huh.
Good.
Hi, how are you?
You sound like you're right next door. Well, listen, before I start badgering you with a good number of questions, Jill, is there anything that you'd like to say before we start?
I'd just like to introduce myself as a grateful believer and survivor of demonic activity, and that I base my life from this point forward. I count myself as grateful, having gone through what I have, because it's brought me so much closer to the Lord, and I really strive by Luke 10:19. I have given you authority to trample on snakes and scorpions and to overcome all the power of the enemy. Nothing will harm you. And as long as I hold true to that and really believe that truth, I go on day to day, and this becomes more and more a part of my past instead of the nightmare present tense that it was for so long. I've had supernatural experiences since I was in my youth, and it culminated in 2006. So I do count myself as a grateful survivor.
Okay, good. And I wanted to get that clear immediately, that regardless of all of the things you've been through, that currently your relationship right now with Jesus Christ, how would you rate it from 1 to 10, 10 being the highest?
10.
Okay, good idea. Because some people may get confused when you start going through some of this testimony that you've been involved with. And because of your very curious nature, and this is one of the things, by the way, that attracted me to your particular story, because I'm the same way. You know, when something gets in my way, I don't want to cower away from it. I like to face up to it, you know, because this is what we had to do, because we had an awful lot of bullies back when I was a little kid. I hated bullies. I really did.
Mm-hmm.
And I would not allow them to take advantage of other people, regardless of anything. See, so I feel that you have the same spirit, and sometimes, and this is what we're going to have to talk about today, but sometimes it can get you in trouble, especially
Absolutely.
When the dynamic is not on the same level plane. We're dealing with spiritual beings here. And I think people are going to be absolutely amazed when they hear some of the things that you've actually did under these very, very difficult circumstances. Okay, so I wanted to get that clear immediately. And the second thing I want to get clear, before we go into these supernatural experiences that you had, Sheila, another thing that attracted me to your story was what you had mentioned about your father, that something happened with your father who was in the Air Force, and perhaps you might just spend a couple of minutes on talking about your father a little bit, and just to see if there's any type of connection between what happened to him and perhaps what you were engaged with yourself starting in the late 1970s.
Well, he had in 1955, as a fighter pilot for the U.S. Air Force, had a UFO encounter, and he said he, no matter what they did, that there was just no way they could catch these guys. They were so ultra-fast, and the machinery was just so far beyond what they were flying that they didn't have a chance catching up to him. But he did have an encounter, and he said he knows many, many fighter pilots and commercial airline pilots that have had similar experiences. He was told it was probably a weather balloon or some other normal object, and was told to stay quiet about it and forget about it. And it's something he's always kept kind of to himself. He shared it with me years ago, but he's a very strong Christian, and reads his Bible every day, and I think that helps him make sense out of what happened.
Right.
But he doesn't talk a whole lot about it.
Right. Well, actually, you're a little bit more lucky than I am. My father said nothing about it. All he did was hand me all these books to read, and I was naive way back when I first started my own research. And, you know, it took me a long time, like it does with all of the other things that I was investigating, to try to put the pieces together and say, you know what, this man had so many strange experiences. I wonder why he's reading all of these books about it. You know, and that included UFOs, you know. So actually, one day I actually confronted him and say, listen, Dad, how come you have given me all these books to read about this particular subject? Was there anything that happened in your life that may have prompted you to do this? You know, very casually, like. And sure enough, that's when he told me that he had seen this cigar-shaped object going up the Hudson River in 1925. Now, your father was 1955, Uh-huh. My father was 1925. Now, 1925 is even more interesting because the only thing they allegedly had around in those days were blimps and Zeppelins and things of that sort. And since my father was in the fire department and the Navy, he was aware of these types of things, and he knew it was strange and unusual. But he kept it to himself because in those days, if you talked about those type of things, you could be in an institution looking out and with nothing but people surrounding you that had nothing but white coats on, see, that type of thing. So anyway, he did level with me, and then I found it intriguing because of the type of ship that he mentioned was exactly like a number of people that I had interviewed and talked to over the years regarding the same subject. So I found that intriguing, too, and it actually spurred me on in the late 80s, and I was all set for what was going to happen to me in the 1990s, which, in fact, did happen. So, but anyway, in your particular situation now, he's having this experience in 1955, but you don't really have anything happen of an extraordinary nature until the late 1970s, if I remember correctly.
Uh-huh.
So why don't you just sort of like take us through the series of things that took place with you, say from the late 70s on through 2000 and so, and see if we can make some sense out of what actually happened with you, okay?
Well, the first experience was in 1977. I was hit as a pedestrian by a drunk driver and nearly died. I was in ICU for 4 days, and while I was in ICU, I came to and was hooked up to, I had tubes coming everywhere and lights flashing, and I couldn't move anything, and I just, all I wanted to know was who had done this to me, and I was angry at God. The pain was just incredible, and I was angry at God because I had learned in Sunday school all my life growing up that He never gives us more than we can handle, and I just said, God, this is more than I can handle. I can't do this, and I wanted to die. I just wanted Him to take me then and there, and I saw a greenish-white glowing light come towards me. It got bigger and bigger, and it stopped and hovered kind of towards the right of my chest, and it was Jesus. I just knew it was Jesus, and I didn't see Him. I just knew in my heart that that's whose voice I heard, and it was a very loving, fatherly voice, but stern, and He said, no, I didn't lie to you. This isn't more than you can handle. You can do this. Go back and heal. And I began improving after that, to the point that I got the nickname Speedy Gonzalez at the hospital. And within a year was walking again, and I had broken a lot of bones from being hit by the pickup truck. And that ever since that happened, it seems like a door was open that never fully closed. That was a good experience, but in 1989, I had a negative experience with a demon that materialized out of the closet. I was in my room sketching, and he was just a foul-mouthed, short, well, half-woman, half-male, half-young, half-old creature with fire hair, fire ponytail, and a forked tongue, and just foul-mouthed, and he demanded that I draw him, and I sketched him for a couple hours, and the last thing he said to me was, I'll be back. And then I had no other occurrences of anything. I just put that aside as, I don't know, to me, I wasn't as, he was scary, but I wasn't as terrified. It didn't affect me to the point that you would expect something like that to. I took it kind of with a grain of salt. To me, I felt extra protected because the Lord had visited me in 1977 from the accident, and I felt that maybe that I was just open to the supernatural because of that experience, and that it wasn't anything to be that that upset about, that it was maybe just going to be a normal occurrence in my life, something that I would need to learn to get, you know, to expect. But nothing else happened until 2004.
Okay, before
when
we
lived in.
Yeah, Sheila, before we get to 2004, if I heard you correctly, you said that this, whatever it was, demon or whatever, was half woman, half man. Did I hear you correctly?
And half child, half old person.
So
a little bit of each, and he would every time I mentioned Jesus, he would go into this mocking crucifixion pose, and instead of being nailed to the cross, he had nooses like when you hang yourself, nooses around his arms. His feet were nailed, but his arms were in nooses, and he'd go into this mocking pose and say something totally derogatory and awful about Christ whenever I mentioned him.
Right. So that did that, and I assume that when that entity did that, that you got the impression that it wasn't an alien, but it had to be something that hated Jesus, correct?
Yeah, to me, aliens at the time, it almost killed me before I came to connect the dots, and through the help of your book and many other sources, I made the connection between the fallen angels and the alien agenda and the connection. But to me at the time, that was in the science fiction realm, which wasn't really that real to me. That was more TV and movies. You know, I wasn't really into aliens or the concept of them at the time. I was very open to angels and demons. That to me, that seemed very realistic and very plausible.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. And of course, one of the attributes of these beings is hermaphrodite. You know, even with the succubus and the incubus, if you read the literature in mythology, and they call it mythology, but we would call it demonology, that's been twisted into a word or a euphemism called mythology. And this is the type of thing that you get in that particular field. This, and it's curious, too, and Zen, you may want to chime in on this, that this is what you see in the Greek myths, these hermaphrodites. Which is a takeover from the Egyptian myths, which is the connecting to the source beings, according to the literature that I have read. And I find it curious that, you know, we're seeing the same things popping up in the 20th century with the same type of attributes attached to them. It's interesting.
Well, I appreciate you. First, I want to thank you both, Greg and Byron, and to the listening audience, and for all of the people out there that sent condolences and regards to me on behalf of my mother. And thank you much, everyone out there, again, for keeping my mother in your prayers. I so appreciate that, and I know my family so appreciates it as well. One of the things that I find intriguing, and this goes back to what you were just talking about, with the mythologies and all the past Earth history and the things that have been so esoteric that most people still just really consider them fables, and like the whole mythology behind the giants and everything. But the thing that intrigues me with Sheila's story is that now, especially now with modern-day America, we have everybody interested in like all these ghost hunter shows and all these different shows where people are going out and researching this paranormal activity, and they're going into these houses where there are these demonic presences, but they don't relate that these presences are the same as those that are abducting and raping women, the extraterrestrial, the alien presence, whatever you want to call it, that activity is the same kind of demonic activity. And so for those that don't put it together in that kind of a way, I find Sheila's story so intriguing, because we have so many people out there in the world right now that are just intrigued, and their interest is so piqued by these ghost hunters and these Taps and all these different shows, and they're opening themselves up to these experiences by playing with Ouija boards and doing different things, tarot cards, whatever it is, and they have no idea what they're doing, and they don't put the connection together, and that's why I think it's important not only to bring forth the Sheila story, because it's not necessarily, you know, just like with all the other testimonies from Joe Jordan and all these other individuals that have had experiences that have been similar but different. And many of them have had the abduction experience and extraterrestrial phenomena and understand that side of it. But a lot of people out there in the world today are having just demonic presences in their house. They don't know what to do. They don't understand how they invited them in and how to get rid of them. And so with Sheila's story and bringing forth Sheila's testimony, it explains the other side of it so that people can make the connection. And I, that's why I think that it's important what we're doing.
Absolutely. And now this is like, yeah, and you know, there's another thing too, which I hadn't even thought about until just now when Sheila was discussing Jesus. Just at the point where she thinks that God had let her down, he's coming back and saying, not only did I not let you down, but I'm showing you I'm real, and I'm preparing you that you will be able to handle what is going to happen to you. You see, when did this all happen? It happened in the late 70s. So now she has an experience in 1989, which would throw a lot of people, I'm sure, if they had an experience like this. And now, Sheila, and we had interrupted you, but you were going to go into this next series of things that happened in somewhere around 2004. Why don't you?
2004. Also, back in 1977, the one thing that I thought was so special was that he had read my mind. You know, I literally said, you promised that you wouldn't give us more than we can handle. And he said, you know, I didn't lie to you. And it was just the fact that we could have that communication without words was so special to me. But
I have to make this side note that the Lord is the only one that can do that. That's
absolutely
how you knew it was the Lord. And I had gotten a confirmation of that from Shandy Byers, who was on the program last in the beginning of this year, and he quoted something to me that I read, if I remember correctly, it was in 1 Kings chapter 8, and if you read that chapter very carefully, you will note that what Sheila just said is confirmed in Scripture. So 1 Kings chapter 8, so I believe. So,
can I make a quick comment, too?
Sure.
I just wanted to say that, you know, Sheila, I had that same similar moment happen to me when I broke my neck when we went off the cliff and dropped 85 feet and I became a quadriplegic. But, you know, it reminds me of the whole footprints, you know, where the Lord carries us in those moments. And we see one set of prints and we think that we've been abandoned and that we're to walk alone. And we have no idea that we're actually on the backs of our Lord and that he's carrying us.
Uh-huh. That's so true.
And he's there whether we know it or not.
Absolutely.
In my own experience, and I think I told you this, Sheila, I wrote a poem called Come to Me, Jesus. And when I was in the pits of despair, when I was living alone, I had asked him to visit me. And it came in a way I never, ever imagined it, but the sum and substance of it was the fact that Jesus was the bread of life, and when I dropped a piece of bread on the floor, it actually disappeared and reappeared subsequently over a 20-minute period. And that was the answer to my prayer, because I had asked him to come. And it dawned on me right then, not only is Jesus the bread of life, but he's there whether we realize it or not. It was so subtle, it was unbelievable. But it actually happened, and I had to pen those words. You see, so I mean, and he treats everybody in a different way. But it's to let you know that he is there. He's as close can be, to prepare us. So what thing, we don't even know what's going to happen to us. We could be dead tomorrow for all we know. But the thing is, he's always there for us to handle. And he even promised us that my grace is sufficient for you. So as we go through this, just keep these things in mind because they're so important for when you think you can't handle something, you know. So, okay now, Sheila, we're in 2004, and I know something else happened here. What was that?
Well, like Jen was saying, you were saying also about the Ghost Hunters show, I kind of went through a phase of that where in 2004 we were in another apartment, and it got to be kind of the cool place to visit for my kids were teenagers at the time, and their friends were all intrigued, and everything was like, wow, you got to talk to to Amanda's mom, and she's got these great stories to tell and all these experiences, and because in that apartment we had just a lot of shadow people experiences. My kids would be woken up in the middle of the night. They'd just sit up in bed and just scream out for me. Something was terrifying them. We had the classic hag, which I had her sitting at the computer with me one night. I opened up the refrigerator door one time, and there was a dead girl from like 1870s in the refrigerator. Just visions that were unbelievable. And I had a closet that I felt that there was evil presence coming from. So I put a tape recorder in there for 3 nights and to try to catch some EVPs. And one of the 3 nights, oh my gosh, it captured some incredible stuff. It's you can hear a female voice say, "Are you there?" And you can hear whistling, and then you can hear this beast at the end. And when I was listening to it, it scared me so much, I threw the headphones off my head, and they came out of the CD player, and it flew across the room. And I, to this day, will never attempt an EVP recording again. It was terrifying. But at the time, it was like a Ghost Hunter episode. You know, that apartment was just known as the haunted apartment, and it was a fascination to my kids' friends and to me, and it's something that again, we didn't take very seriously. I felt that I must have, because of my curiosity, perhaps I had sinned, and the Lord was stepping back and letting me deal with this on my own. I don't feel like he had abandoned me. There were points later on that I really felt abandoned, but again, it was because I felt it was my own sin from associating with people that were into the dark arts, and it must have been something that I had done a sin on my part that he felt that I needed to go through this.
Right. Now, this paranormal experiences that was a series of paranormal experiences that you had, it's not just confined to one apartment. Is that correct?
No, after the EVPs, I put in for a change of apartment, and we needed to move into a bigger spot anyway because my kids were getting older and needed their own rooms. And so anyway, we stayed in the same apartment complex but moved into a larger apartment in a different circle. And when we first moved into this new place where we're still at now, the first thing I did is I just ran upstairs and I just took in the whole atmosphere of the place, and I just said to the kids, it's clean, it's totally clean, and I could, and I meant by spiritually, I could just, it felt so free of any demonic activity, and it was just a wonderful feeling, and I was so happy. And so we moved in, and with great expectations, and suddenly around the end of 2005, 2006, things started happening. And they ended up being the worst of the worst out of the whole collection of experiences.
Yeah, now when you say the worst of the worst, I'm thinking that is this the reference to the virtual surgeries? Is that what you're referring
to? That was part of it. I did have some alien encounters, and the virtual surgeries were, I call them virtual surgeries because they seemed, I wasn't never taken somewhere where I, you know, saw a lab table, or, you know, where things like that. It was more sensations. You had sent me something, it was chapter 8 of Powers, Physics, and Science the other day in the email, and it totally it explains it very, very, very much. It's fallen angelic apparitions and mental attacks, and it was visions real to the body senses, full or partially overlaying objective reality, fully awake or awaking trance state. And then physical attacks with, they can be visible angels or invisible angels. In my case, it was invisible. And it says, I just wanted to read this because it was, it totally fits what was going on with me. I think
the
fallen angels.
Sheila, before you read that, I want to reference it for the listening audience, because if they are intrigued by what you're about to say, they can read it themselves online.
Okay.
Just by Googling Nicole Malone, she's called Paradox Brown. That's her pen name. But she wrote the book, A Modern Guide to Demons and Fallen Angels. And this chapter 8, which is what you are going to quote from, I assume, this is a very, very important chapter. Not only for the virtual surgeries, but also for many, many other things related to the abilities of fallen angels. And Nicole seems to have a knack for digging into these very complex issues and explaining them in a way that are not only true scientifically, which she uses very interesting citations from Einstein and Stephen Hawking and other doctors that are very well versed in these subjects, but also she relates the same thing to Scripture at the same time. I found this extraordinary. So when I was going through your material, I said, oh boy, you need to see this, what Nicole did. And of course, Nicole was one of our guests back in the latter part of January this same year. You know, the husband of the wife of Guy Malone. This is Nicole Malone. But okay, Sheila, I wanted people to know that because this is a very, very important chapter and has a lot to do with the very nature of what we're trying to uncover in the Cursed Net. Okay, go ahead.
I love the way she uses the word quantum dice, referring to quantum physics and interdimensional realities, that you can apply this aspect of science to what's going on, and that biblical scripture actually backs it up. She says, I think that fallen angels being able to control in a limited sphere of influence how the quantum dice fall would work as a way to explain physical attacks very easily, both with visible angels materializing or seeing the physical effects of invisible angels. In my case, I had one incident during a sexual attack that I was being choked, and I had finger marks on my neck, actually. I looked in the mirror afterwards. And then I have some abnormalities to my feet after one of the virtual surgeries where my feet were switched around to the opposite legs and then put back. She goes on to say, regarding mental visions and the mental aspects of combination attacks, all of our physical senses are dependent on how our brain interprets them. By fallen angels generating electrical impulses in the brain, and I used to get what I would call buzzing. My whole body would just buzz like it was electrified. Such things like that, fallen angels would be able to make us see things that are not actually in front of our eyes, which would be the virtual surgeries, feel things that are not touching our bodies, which would be like the sexual experiences, smell things that are not before our noses. I used to definitely have, there was one entity that would come around that had a certain smell. I could totally sense, I knew it was him by his smell. They would occur awake or in a waking trance state and could fully or partially overlay objective reality. Now, in my case, I used to have, I would lay down and have, in my mind, a wheel would start to spin, and then a second wheel would spin the opposite direction, and they would get close enough to touch, and as soon as they touched, there'd be a spark, like a welder's flame. And as soon as that flame happened, that spark, I would feel like zero gravity, and that's when the attacks would take place. But I always went through this process mentally of the wheel spinning and the flash, and then whether it was a surgery of some type. I hesitate to call them virtual anymore because I have some pictures of my foot that they just don't look normal. I've got an X-ray, and there's colored wire all throughout the X-ray in the bone, and I've got in your book you talk about them taking a scoop of tissue, and I found that very interesting because I didn't really remember anything like that happening until I found these pictures the other night, and I was looking at them and looked at this one foot picture, and sure enough, there's a puncture wound, a scoop mark out of my bottom of my foot, and then it's glowing kind of a neon dome glow next to it. Mm-hmm. And so I do have had some physical markings, which may make them not so virtual after all and maybe more real.
And keep in mind, Sheila, we had a woman on in December of 2008 by the name of Joyce Ahrens, and she was describing an out-of-body experience that she was undergoing at that exact moment where she was flying low in her neighborhood, and her husband inadvertently had opened and slammed the door, and the couch she was lying on, it startled her, and her outer body came back into her body. But before it did, it hit a pole in its head, and then it went back into the body, and Joyce woke up, and she saw her husband, and she remembered what happened, and lo and behold, now this is the key to the whole thing, that reminded me of your virtual surgeries. Lo and behold, she felt her head, and she had a huge bump on her head. Even though it was happening in an out-of-body experience, now it was apparently or allegedly transferred to her physical third-dimensional body.
Uh-huh. I would be very sore afterwards, depending on what body part they were working on. I'd be very sore afterwards. Mm-hmm. In that area.
Yeah. So, you know, it almost lends itself to, you know, maybe Nicole's on the right track. I mean, you know, when I read this thing, I reread it because it was so fascinating to me. I'm ticking off all of the things that happened to me that I could not answer. And here, Nicole, you know, with this, you use the expression quantum dice, you know, the fallen angels can determine how quantum dice will fall. Well, guess what? If that's true, then that accounts for four things that happened to me. One was a sight thing where I saw a sugar bowl bow in slow motion, which I tried to duplicate but could not. That was weird. The second thing was a sound. I actually heard a sound in my right ear, and I wasn't sleeping when I heard it. I distinctly heard this one word. And then there was a feeling thing. One time something pushed my shoulder. And there was nobody there, by the way. And of course, you could talk about things like this, right? And then the last time was a smell that was actually predicted was going to happen. And sure enough, this same smell happened to me where nothing could have been rigged regarding this thing. And I'm saying to myself, oh, my goodness, maybe this is part of the abilities of fallen angels that they can rig things. And, you know, if you read the whole chapter, there is an expression there, you know, and Nicole says, you know, we have length of time, you know, we look at things linearly, right? But you know what? There's also a width of time. And this is in the domain of the fallen angels, where while things are happening linearly and through length of time, they can expand things in a moment of time called the width of time, where time can go by, but yet they seem to happen immediately. And she puts her finger on that, and she even uses a scriptural quote when Jesus was being tempted by the devil before he started his three-year mission, you know, where he was brought up to a mountain in a moment of time and shown all of these things that would, the devil had the hubris to say, I'll give you all of this if you bow down and adore me. But Nicole uses this as an example of the width of time, and then she goes on to explain how Stephen Hawking had actually grappled with the same concept. You see?
I like the way she breaks it into three categories also, of the mind envelopment and the full body envelopment and then actual materialization, and how you can have the three different types.
Yes.
Which I think I've experienced one and two, the first and second, perhaps three with the few times that I saw aliens would be an actual materialization. And I like the way she also says that just because modern science hasn't caught up with the Bible, it doesn't mean that it's not true, you know, that the Bible really backs up the truth of the Word of God and how these fallen angels do have the abilities to do these types of things.
Yeah. By the way, we can add to that evolution, too. Evolutionists haven't caught up with the truth of the Bible yet either. But if they were to go on the site, Creation on the Web, and see all of the anomalies that surround the facts and the narrative of the book of Genesis, as opposed to their far-flung theories and assumptions, maybe they would start to be converted to an understanding of what really took place around 6,000 years ago. You see? So, yeah, science is filled with hubris. Matter of fact, in the introduction, I mentioned this book, Buried Alive, by John Clouseau, who just happens to be an orthodontist, just happens to be the type of person that went beyond the museums and went beyond the curator's office and went to the dusty back rooms and started to look and poke around and connect the dots of what really they had in the back rooms that never seems to make it to the surface where the people gawk at museums to see what really the information they have and what a real scientist could do if he was privy to that type of information.
Can I add something here, Byron? Whenever you're done with your comment.
Yeah, I just go ahead, Zen. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I was just going to say that one of those things that the Bible is clear on that science doesn't even want to grapple with, doesn't even want to adhere to the possibilities of, is the fact that there were giants on land prior to the flood and after. And that we know that there has been historically documented in little towns all over the United States and all over the world where actual skeletons as tall as 30 foot tall and some with skulls that actually have horns protruding out of them have been found and reported. The Smithsonian Institute comes in and it disappears. The evidence disappears. The skeletons disappear. There, in a documentary we have on the Fallen Angels website, it was done by the History Channel, and it's about the giants. It's a six-part documentary that I think was actually well done. But in that, they are interviewing this one particular archaeologist who was part of an excavation where they found some skeletons in one cave, and all of those skeletons ended up disappearing after they reported them, and you know the proper people came in to take care of the excavating and removing this and all that and documenting this and all that, and then it all disappears, and that there's, you know, science cannot explain that, but the Bible very clearly, and throughout the Old Testament there are numerous stories about the involvement of this species of being in the affairs of humanity.
Absolutely.
And how we have warred against them since, you know, the beginning of time. And so, Yeah, that's one thing that they'll completely ignore as well.
Yeah, that's true, Zen, and I've seen much, much evidence to that effect. You know, it's like the old saying with the Roach Motel. They check in, but they don't check out.
Right.
That reminds me of the Smithsonian Institute, where they find embarrassing things, let's say in the northwest corner of the Grand Canyon, for instance, that would indicate a connection between the Indians of that area and the Egyptians who just happened to have the same god,
you see, right,
in their own lexicography. But the Smithsonian Institute would find this too disturbing to have people know about, so they close up the whole area and they cart everything away that they found in the caves in this particular area. And this was talked to one of the people who, David, what's his name?
Hatcher Childress?
Yes, that's right. David Childress actually talked to this subject in his Ancient Civilization series, which is very, very interesting. So I did a little research on the Smithsonian Institute, and they don't have a very good record of checking out things that have been checked in. So, and this is
right.
Exactly what John Cuozzo came in contact with, and why both himself and his family were actually being threatened and harassed in France when he was coming upon this information, because he had very sophisticated machinery as an orthodontist, you see. So, but let's not get too far afield here. Of course, you know, in my own book, The Cursed Net, that I co-authored with Richard Stout, I mentioned Stephen Quayle's work, Genesis 6 Giants, which
right.
deals with these many, many historical sourced information from scholars, over 400 sources in this particular book alone, that shows evidence of giants both alive and dead all over the world, not just limited to the Middle East or Germany or Ireland, where they found a tremendously large skeleton, which... You know, how do you answer these kind of questions unless you take Genesis 6:4 and look at it through the eyes of the Ethiopian Book of Enoch? That's when it gets interesting.
Absolutely.
But anyway, I don't want to get too far afield here, Sheila, and these virtual surgeries. Let me just ask you one question before we go on to the next thing, because people are probably scratching their head. How do you know when you're having a virtual surgery as opposed to a real surgery? What really triggers it?
I would say just lack of blood and scars and things like, you know, the time frame, the fact that I didn't leave my living room or the bedroom when it happened, you know, and perhaps maybe it's selective memory, you know, perhaps there's only a certain amount I'm really allowed to remember. Maybe there's more to it. But in my mind, I would go into like this trance state. I'd be awake, but I couldn't move. They couldn't move me. I could move my arm up above my head or my arms behind my back and things like that, but I myself was paralyzed to do anything about it. But I was awake, and in with my eyes closed. I tried to open my eyes one time, and the laser lights were so bright I had to shut them immediately. I couldn't open my eyes, but I saw. It's like watching a movie on your eyelids, you know, with your eyes closed. I completely saw four or five aliens in black high-necked cloaks file in very solemnly, and I knew they were in charge of the procedure. And there was always a woman's voice very far off in the distance, as if she was explaining it to a symposium or an audience of some type, what the procedure was, and They did the feet switching. I had a lot of abdominal work. There were times that my legs were just scalpeled, just sliced up and down with nothing taken out or anything like that, but just the sensation of being cut. A double mastectomy, eye or brain, something in that area, procedure one time. That was the last one. That one was so painful. I had like a little mini seizure afterwards. And that led to the showdown. That's when I had finally had enough. Because this went on for about a year, a very long time. The first 30 days or so were just weirdness, where I thought I had done some research on transcranial stimulation and voice-to-skull technology and things like that, and I thought maybe I was part of an experiment for the bio-sci department at the university across the street, or perhaps I had ticked off a satanic cult that was messing with me because I had these cursed, they were like little candies with demon faces pressed into them and colored ribbon left on my porch for about a month. Every day it was a different colored ribbon and it was twisted in a different design with this little same little like brown sugar candy pressed demon face. And so there were weird things like that. I made a hole in the drywall in the bathroom because I knew they were coming. I just knew it was coming from the stairwell under this one part of the house. They used to call it the coming and going place. And I saw five black stones in a circle with a chair. And there was an electrical light bulb on. And there's no reason that any human being should be in there. There's no way to even get into there. It's inside part of the drywall of the house, the framework of the apartment. So there was demonic activity that had to have been humanly done, I guess it's what you call Satan Incorporated. We get into that area. Because of those experiences, I called the police out several times and said I'm being harassed either by the university or an unwilling participant in an experiment, or there's a satanic cult that's harassing me. Maybe it's my neighbors, and they would just be in a trance when they would come out. They were just oblivious to my concerns. And it got to the point where I finally, one time I called them out and I said, I want a sergeant to come out here. I don't want your normal two policemen in a cop car that come out every time. I want somebody above their heads to come out because it's still going on and I need some answers and some protection. And so they sent a sergeant out, and he said to me, Sheila, called me by my first name, and he just said, Sheila, you've been through a lot in your life and you're going to get through this too. And he patted my hand and they left. And my mom was here at the time, and I just looked at her and I just said, why would he say that to me? What in the world was that? Just very strange actions by humans along with this, demonic activity that was going on. So I was just at a loss as to whether it was, like I said, a satanic cult or that there was a spell over the house that just when people got around here, including the police, that they were put under some kind of trance. That's what it seemed like to me. The reaction was just very strange.
So now, when you say it led to a showdown, what is the end of the showdown?
Well, I went after that last surgery that I had the little seizure afterwards. I went to my church. I had been to my church before to a healing service to try to help with the situation, and they put holy oil on my forehead and the sign of the cross, and my stomach shook. Like, my whole dress was moving. My stomach was shaking so badly when they did that. And I went back to the church again to try to get some strength before. I had no I had no qualms about getting in their face or calling them out. And to me, it was, I just felt like I was alone to fight them, and I always demanded to know who was in charge and who was doing this to me. And I knew that it was just going to take a final confrontation to get this over and done with, to find out what it was what it would take to get rid of them. And whenever I would think about doing that or research things about how to report something like this or try to research demonic activity or research scientific things that had to do with what could be going on, I would get automatic writing a lot of times. One time they said, do you know who we are or who I am? And it said 666. And another time, a lot of times it would put my son, they would write my son's name, James, and I would get it on my skin or in the grass or on the cement when I was sitting outside. So they were threatening my children, and I felt this extreme protection. It's just a mother's instinct to protect your children, and there was no way in the world I was going to let them go through a minute of what I'd been going through. So I went to the church and to try to get some advice before doing this. I knew I was going to meet them in a neutral place away from the kids, and so I checked into a hotel that night. But before, when I was at the church, so it was very, very strange. I was talking to the priest, and he levitated. He went up on his tiptoes, and his toes weren't touching the ground. So I started seeing visions and hallucinations and stuff there. And he said to me, he looked at me, and he said, "Pete will have a piece of you too." And I don't know who he was referring to, but it terrified me. I ended up, Pete will have a piece of you too. Mm-hmm. And then he levitated off of his toes, and it was terrifying. I left my Bible there, and I ran I don't know how many miles home, and said I figured they had infiltrated the church, or I had brought it with me. And the last thing I wanted to do was to bring that towards, you know, there to the church. So I went to the hotel that night, and I was standing out on the balcony, and the stars and the moon just disappeared from the sky. It was a beautiful night out, and it went black. And except there were three helicopters that were just hovering, pointed right towards the hotel. I went inside and laid down on the couch, and this automatic writing started on the ceiling, and it was a long dissertation saying that, yes, it was Satan that was behind all this madness, and that I hadn't been that good of a Christian as I had thought I had been, and my curiosity being involved with men who were into the dark arts had been a big part of it, and that he wanted my soul to save my children, that if I joined his forces that he would leave my kids alone. And I was just about to say yes, and then it dawned on me that had to be a lie. And see, they wanted my place. They wanted my apartment. I was always getting messages of go, leave, die, stupid girl, that they wanted the apartment. There was something about this place that they wanted. And there were many times I almost put on my shoes and just started walking, and I was just going to leave. And I wonder how many homeless people there are that have had experiences like this. I'll never look at a homeless person again the same way, because they could be tormented with these lies that, yeah, if you do what they say, if you leave and go as they command, or give your soul to them, and that they'll save your children, spare your children. Well, it's just a lie. There's no reason that they're not going to come back and still do the same terrible more things. So I was just about to say yes, though, and a voice said to me, "Sheila, you don't have to deal with these guys. You you're protected. You and your children are protected. You don't have to make a deal with him. And I said, I choose Jesus out loud. And I said it strong, and I said it loud, and it went away. The writing went off the ceiling. Everything just went away. It was a complete change. And I was just worn to shreds by that morning. It was almost dawn by then. And I walked home, and I walked in the apartment, and it was quiet, and I didn't sense anybody in the stairwell or in the coming or going place, and it just seemed like it was gone.
Yes, it's gone, and the key phrase there is when you chose Jesus, this is when all this stuff just stopped, correct?
Uh-huh.
Isn't that interesting? There's an old phrase, you know, once a liar, always a liar. If you believe the father of lies, well, you think he's ever going to stop lying to you? And you're willing to give up your soul for your children. I find this extraordinary that you're willing to go to such lengths in order to protect your children, which under other circumstances would be a very good thing. But
can I make a comment here, Byron, Okay, well, I was just going to say that this similar circumstance with Sheila wanting to protect her children is the same thing that the Lord tells us when we, you know, he says, do not take the mark of the beast. That a lot of people in their churches, they say, well, I know the Lord will forgive me if I do this, if I do it for my children. Like, if they think that they can take the mark if it's going to help them to take care of their children. And I've heard people say that where it says specifically, precisely in the Bible to not take that mark. And so, you know, this is a lesson for us here too, to always rely on our Lord and do what he commands and what he says, what he warns us about in the Word.
Okay, now, Sheila, there's an awful lot of things I still have questions about, and I bit my tongue with the follow-up questions because we need to discuss a few very, very important things. One of them has to do with these men in the crayon trucks.
Uh-huh.
And I know you felt very strongly about this to the extent that you actually wrote a poem about it, and I'd like you to read that if you have it handy, if you could do that, because it might throw a light, no pun intended, it may throw a light on other things that we could discuss subsequently. But before you even do that, did these men in these trucks, did you see them before or after the showdown period, or how did that all come about?
That was before. They disappeared after the showdown. I still to this day I look around for an abundance of trucks and I don't see them. There never were that many around in our area, and suddenly I just noticed a lot of trucks. And I call them the crayon men in the crayon colored trucks because they were you know, that yellow and blue, the true crayon colors. And one time I was driving to my parents' house and you know, I have a picture of vapors coming out of the carpet. I used to call it sleepy gas. It would make me render me motionless before an attack, and it came out of the carpet, and I have some photos of it. And that actually happened at my parents' house. So as far as my dad's UFO encounter, I believe either I brought the evil with me to their house when I was staying over there, or they have their own problem going on with that. But regardless, I saw the trucks at both their area of town and my area of town, and I was driving over to their house one day, and I had one in front of me and one behind me, and the one in front of me, his license plate was Evil333. And the guy behind me was YXPLANE. Mm-hmm. And when at 3:33 in the morning is always the time that the activity would stop, or if it was a night that no activity was going on, I'd still always wake up at 3:33. There'd be like a bang or a door closing or a truck leaving from the front of the house. Something always happened at 3:33 in the morning. So that became a very familiar time for me.
Yeah.
But after I said I choose Jesus, I had no trouble with the trucks at all. At the time that they were leaving the ribbon and the demon faces on my doorstep, I'd go out at night and there'd be trucks parked in there's a shopping center across the alley from where we live, and you can see part of the parking lot, and they'd be parked facing my apartment. A lot of times when there'd be an attack, I'd look out the window afterwards and there'd be a red truck or a white truck in the parking lot of our apartment complex. And we've lived here since 1994, and they weren't anybody that lived here or that that used to come around. It was a new phenomenon.
Do you think it was military?
No, they looked like... You know, I think the police were involved in it at some level. The way they reacted to me was just, you know, oh, it's just 50 Cornell again. You know, there was some type of government involvement. As far as the trucks go, I always thought it was a satanic cult of some type. That was just my instincts.
Right. Yeah. Well, if that's the case. Why?
It could be government, though.
Mm-hmm. And why the bright colors?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Now, you know, that's interesting. This is Greg, by the way. That's interesting that you mentioned Sheila, the 3:33. That seems to be kind of an ongoing theme in the this new release called The Fourth Kind that just opened Friday. And I only know that from the previews, but it seems they have used that time in particular as one of the as the time that these people have been abducted in Alaska. And,
oh, really?
Yes, and I only know that from the previews because I noticed, and you'll see even on their website, thefourthkind.net. You'll see on the trailer they'll show the clock saying 3:33 in the morning, and I think it has something to do. There's some symbolism behind it. What it is, I don't know.
Greg, I know a number of people, you know, having traversed this field for 40 years, abductees. Literal abductees who have been examined as such, and they invariably wake up at 3:33 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a key number, and of course we can't escape the possibility that is a Freemason link to 3:33 also. You see, it's not a haunt. It's dark-sided because the Freemasons, as we do know, are Luciferian connected. And
right.
There may be the answer to the riddle of Satan Incorporated that we use in our book, that once you've aligned yourself with the dark side, it can, in fact, use you as one of their pawns, one of their minions, one of their puppets or muppets, as certain people would say. And therefore, you are, and especially if you've been obsessed or possessed, this means that, in effect, Satan is working through you through the demons, you see?
Yes.
And the fallen angels have a lot to do with setting that whole scenario up to entice you in. Once you've been enticed in, the demons take over. So it's a 1-2 punch. That's why we called it Satan Incorporated. Now, I was very curious, Sheila, because they use this 3:33 imagery, why don't you read the poem... And then let's try to make some sense, if we can, out of now that people understand what you went through here, that what you had to go through. And remember, this all stopped when you called on Jesus and you relied on him. But this was all activity going on, setting things up, it seems. So why don't you read that poem, because I know you feel passionately about this particular subject, and let's see if we can make some sense out of it.
Okay, I will. I do feel passionate about it. They became such a part of my life that it was so invasive and so frightening to not know who they were, and it was so obvious that it coincided with the level of activity, and then the fact that it stopped was just amazing. That the difference was incredible. But it's called The Men in Crayon Colored Trucks. And by the way, the quote in here I really did cross the alley to walk over to the store, and this gentleman actually really did say this to me. As I waited across the alley, my silly mind was struck by a stranger's comment, "I'm sorry for my really big truck." Part of an apology I was owed, not by a lover, but by an eternal foe. They drove trucks like great horses, his white like a knight. But his motive was not fun, seduction by fright. A tug of war for sanity and property, territory, but I have nowhere to flee. One pre-dawn request was met the next day as a truck pulled near, then sped away. I just wanted to explain the night before, but I panicked and hid my face to the floor. Not the first missed opportunity, me as cowardly as thee. But I promised to take it to my grave. They hate me so because I misbehave. I interrupted his game, a sport I didn't choose to court, and the fee for such, time will only tell. Surely the best thing is to keep me well. It's okay if I never know and stay free and forget about trucks and 333.
Well, and this is based on an actual true event. You weren't hyperbolizing or exaggerating in any way, shape, or form with this, correct?
True, uh-huh.
Now, I was struck by a couple of things. First of all, you mentioned the word property. Now, does that mean that they're looking upon you as a piece of property?
No, that was the fact that they wanted this apartment. One time I was at my bedroom window, which is upstairs. It's like a condo, two-story, little upstairs, downstairs apartment. And I was upstairs, and I was looking out my window, and there's a bush out in the backyard that has the strangest handmade sharp barrier around it. It's what I called the coming and going place. I felt like they came from underground from there. And anyway, I was looking down at the bush, and I saw this witch sitting there. And she just telepathically just told me that I was in the way, that this was their place. And that nothing would get in the way of their mission, of what they had to accomplish, and that I was to move and to leave. And so I call her the Bush Witch, and so that's what I meant by property and territory, that they were after my home.
Wherever you were could have been an interdimensional portal from a spiritual point of view. You know,
yes, it was. I felt that they were very angry that they hated me. They hated me so much that the fact that when I moved in here, maybe because of being a Christian in the first place, that I was not supposed to be who moved into this apartment. Now that it's all over, I feel I feel ownership and I feel safe and well grounded here. All that's, you know, back to normal. But during that time, I was felt very much like I was in the way, that this was their place.
So in other words, you being a Christian, that's you're misbehaving by being a Christian. Right?
Yes, and by getting in their face by being so. It's like when I had the alien experience in the stairwell, when he told me if I would quit making such a fuss that I could go back to Sedonia. I was not a willing participant. I was kicking and screaming the whole way, and I was constantly on the internet trying to find ways to who to report something like this to, or how to explain it, trying to find some kind of rationalization as to what was going on. I didn't just passively let it happen.
Right. Okay, now, we're going to go a little bit over, ladies and gentlemen, because there is just a number of things we need to tie together before we end this particular program. So if we go off stream, just understand this may go a little while longer. All right.
I've extended this another half hour. Baron.
Oh, good.
Okay.
Good,
so
great.
Any yep for the live.
Okay,
listeners.
That
okay.
takes a little
Excellent.
Bit of the right. That takes a little bit of the pressure off, and I'm sure there'll be a number of questions. But you know, Sheila, when you bring up this stuff, especially with the title of this, "The Men in the Colored Crayon Trucks," I immediately thought of the essay that Richard Stout had written, Light, Color, and Sound Uses Within the Satanic Kingdom.
Uh-huh.
And we had a roundtable discussion on this very subject with Dr. Joy Pugh, based on her observations and insights into how the dark side, including the New World Order, which is lumped into the satanic net, the cursed net, okay, and we noticed, and Richard did an awful lot of research into showing how light, color, and sound uses, much like what Nicole Malone did with the virtual reality of the fallen angels, Richard did with an understanding of the light, color, and sound, because it keeps coming up in ufology that anybody who does the a modicum of study in this subject realizes that it's not just the UFO. It's a UFO with bright lights, not just ordinary lights, bright lights, and they change colors from yellow to green to blue and red, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I noticed it innumerable times in my own research, to the extent that I was actually commenting on this essay as Richard wrote it. Now, I bring this up because I have an idea, at least an interpretation of what might be happening here. It has to do with the entities in this truck are not haphazardly placed at near your locale, but are intricately connected, using colors, by the way, based on what has just transpired with you, possibly. Okay, that's where the 333 comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Because it happens after 333. In other words, if you're coming outside of an abduction, right, the best thing that can happen from their point of view would be to program you by the use of light, colors, and sounds as to the activities that will transpire between that and the next abduction. So it's almost like they're treating you like a piece of property who needs to be corralled and needs to be subjugated to their agenda, not yours. And what we found in this particular essay, Light, Color, and Sound Uses, all sorts of indications that this is in fact true. Matter of fact, Richard even starts off in, this is a two-part essay, in part one, this is how he frames it. This is Richard Stout talking. I believe that specific light and color patterns, intensities, frequencies, etc., can alter our brain functions from the normal emotion to an altered state of emotional stimuli. Light and color can induce signals that trigger often certain emotions through our senses. And then he goes on later in the essay to indicate that even the very word color itself, he uses keyword analysis, and when he did the keyword analysis on the word color, lo and behold, the word color means, quote, a false appearance or action intended to deceive. When I first read that, I said, oh, my goodness. Is that right? Is that what colors are all about? And who else knows about this, the phenomena of colors, and how do they use it to deceive? You see? And then he goes on in the essay and he talks about light signals that can actually paralyze you. This is all documented information on things that they found out through experimentation. And a fellow by the name of Max Lusher found out that colors and light can be used both for healing as well as leaving us open to suggestion. So, you know, when you read this stuff and you start to look at the overlays in ufology, it's very hard to miss the point that light and colors may be used as some type of a post-hypnotic suggestion.
I know they made me feel very compliant and defenseless and really hopeless. You know, I would see them and I would just feel like I had no chance against them. It really rendered me defenseless when I'd see them. It was
That's right.
Not a good feeling.
It's not a good feeling. And when Richard got to the point where he was actually evaluating what the different colors stand for, like if you see bright red, that is a color of motivation. It's to get you stimulated. Just like yellow gets you to be happy, or green gets you to feel cozy and warm, and blue, the color that you had an association with, guess what it does? It relaxes you.
Mm-hmm.
You see, just like an anesthetic would do. But instead of using an anesthesia, they could possibly be using colors. If you're having these virtual surgeries with no blood or anything, maybe it's all of these colors that they use in order to keep you in a state where you don't necessarily feel it then. Of course, you do later. You mentioned that before, but that's later. But what, just like an ordinary anesthesia, you have an anesthesia so you don't go crazy during an operation, but later on you still feel the effects of it when you wake up.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the same thing with the toothache, et cetera. So, see, this is, and now, so what does all this thing, what does all this mean? Well, if anybody wants to actually read this essay, Greg Messina has it on his website, revelation7.com, and it's under the webpage called Light and Color from UFOs. Just click on that, it'll bring you right to the this essay, and in it, I comment on what Richard Stout actually does. And I refer you to another essay that I wrote regarding a UFO-related book called Night Siege, and I call it Night Siege Within the Cursed Net, because if you were to read that book carefully, you would notice that there's umpty-dumpty amounts of paranormal activity going on revolving around what? Lights and colors and sounds that get people to do things. You see?
By the way, that's revelationvii.com with the Roman numerals. That's Roman numeral 7.
Right. Thank you, Greg.
You're welcome.
Yeah, because sometimes people put 7 and know it's got to be the VII because Roman numerals come into sway here. But you see, I find all of this fascinating. Now, why is this fascinating to me? Because when I was reading your story and I read this poem, and I see the keys, Evil 333, why explain? Well, yeah, because if in fact abductions end at 333, which I know for a fact they do in many, many instances, because that's when you wake up. That's when you start remembering it. They dump you back on the bed and you wake up and you see the clock. Who knows if that could even be programming you when you see that number. You know, you get a post-hypnotic suggestion. When you see that number, it's telling you to be aware of certain things. Maybe the things that you're being told to be aware of have to do with the trucks, and the trucks have to do with colors, and the colors have to do with pre-programming. You see where I'm going with this?
Uh-huh.
Because you said that this is when you see the trucks, after you wake up, you know, sometime afterward. That may not be immediately.
Sometimes I see them in the daytime, but always at the end, yeah.
Yeah.
So you're saying, Byron, that the trucks could be a trigger to induce some kind of response or behavior?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And only because when I was trying to put those pieces together, I superimposed our essay, I superimposed the information from Nicole Malone's Chapter 8, and use the information from Night Siege and the material that we had from the Cursed Net, and I say, what a beautiful way to keep programming somebody on an ongoing basis.
Right.
And by the way, they use this in the New World Order. There are books like Thanks for the Memories by Bryce Taylor, whose real name is Susan Ford, and she was coded to remember things when she did particular things. Like if she went through a McDonald's arch, she would forget everything that she what she just went through. See, that was the eraser part of the experience. These people are extremely clever. Now, you have the dark side people who work through what? Secret societies. And what do they use? Secret signs. And what do these signs do? They tell people how much they can tell or not tell people, because everything in Satan Incorporated is compartmentalized.
Right.
Just like the UFO phenomenon is compartmentalized, so that you'll never get to the bottom of it, because they're so clever, or they think they're so clever, in the ways they go about hiding everything. And this is what I think has been going on with you, Sheila, up to that point where you, the showdown, and now all of this stuff goes away. You see? Oh, and one of those things... Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, the riddle of evil 333 that you wrote, explained, just surmises it so well. Evil 333 starts here, my dear. As our varied colored crayon truck shows you what to wear and think and share. So why explain any further? Just be our little pet and give us a little kiss, and we can send you to Sedonia Bliss.
Oh.
That's just it. You captured it.
Well, yeah, and people will say, what is he talking about with this little kiss and Sedonia Bliss? Maybe you bold little woman, you can tell us exactly what happened in the shower that time before the showdown, and what lengths you were willing to go to deal with these entities.
Well, I had tried everything. I had been angry with them. I tried to be compliant. I tried to rationalize. I tried to bargain. I had just tried everything. So I decided one night to try to befriend them. And I was in the shower, and I saw an alien image on the shower wall. And so I gave it a little kiss on the cheek. And I heard this just gasp of horror from somewhere. And I got out of the shower and just doubled over in pain. I almost blacked out, and stood back up, and was completely, something that was so different was so wrong with me. I got dressed and I went out to have dinner with my family, and well, before that happened too, when I stood back up, I heard the words, "I am you," and I said out loud, "I know." And I just knew something terrible had happened. And I went outside. I went out to try to have dinner with my family, and I couldn't walk right. I couldn't chew right. I wrote left-handed for a couple hours. Everything felt awkward inside of me. My body didn't fit my own skin. I wasn't comfortable in my own skin, and I felt something. I had done something. I had crossed some border, some barrier that was a very big no-no by doing what I had done.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You talk about door opening, and when you give somebody a kiss, that's usually a sign of love. I mean, could you? You know, just an expression. When somebody sneezes, people say "God bless you," and from what I understood about that was that you're saying "God bless you" because you are wishing that no evil you inhale when you sneeze. Did you know that?
Uh-huh.
Well, it doesn't take a genius to figure out, if you see something on the wall that could be, for all practical purposes, a demonic entity, whether it's a shadow or whether it's taking some type of etheric form, and you kiss it, you are in fact inhaling it, in essence, literally. So it says, "I am you," and maybe you wasn't kidding at that point. So this is why we said in the beginning, where do you stand now which a relationship with Jesus Christ. Now, obviously, you took very stringent steps to make sure that this was out of you. The experiences at church indicated there was still something going on there. And now, thanks be to God, you're at a point where you can, you have seen, you have gone to the edge in a sense, literally. And you see what it's like when you really do dabble with these dark forces and they don't say, they don't mean what they say, and everything's a lie or a deception, or as we keep saying, you know, it's part of a sting operation.
And I was so naive. I really thought that I had an that there was a chance that I could make friends with them and they would go away.
Yeah.
I really believed that.
Yeah, even like you indicated that you wrote left-handed for a few hours. Somebody try writing. If you're a right-handed person, try writing left-handed and see how far you'll get.
Oh, and I wrote beautifully left-handed too. It wasn't scribble scratch. It was, you know.
Yeah, and guess what, Sheila? There is a woman that I interviewed on TV who brought a daughter. Her name is Betty Andreas and Luca. Okay. And we interviewed her for quite some time, and Betty Andreessen's daughter, by the name of Becky, had an implant in her right arm, and then before you know it, that implant wiggled its way down to her right hand, and the next thing you know, she was writing in an alien language, which she only understood under hypnosis.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, it gets better, though, because when I quizzed her about this, who are the beings that you're dealing with here? Because, you know, the whole point of this thing ostensibly was that she was going to be teaching this new language to children. Keep that in the back of your mind. And I had asked her, well, what's the name of the entity that you're dealing with, you know? I didn't know what she was going to say. You know what she said? Ishtar. Ishtar. I said in my breath, because at that point I hadn't even put all the dots together. But Ishtar is the same being that's related to Isis,
exactly.
The goddess Isis from Egypt, the consort to Osiris from the constellation Orion. I mean, we're dealing with the cream of the crop of the dark side here. You see? So, There's a lot to be said for people that, and believe you me, when I met Betty Andreas and Luca, she was the nicest person in the world, a fundamentalist Christian. But does that mean she couldn't be manipulated with the promise of seeing wonderful things? And by the way, Sheila, one of the things she saw was a picture of Cydonia in greenish mist.
Ah.
And now,
wow.
I was taken with that when I read your material about this is the gift they're going to give you. You'll be able to go back to Cydonia. Why don't you tell the listening audience about that story?
Well, I was the stairway, and the wall turned to the most beautiful shade of blue you've ever seen. Just hundreds of lights, little teeny lights just in rows like a circuit board. And there was suddenly a very elderly, like very stately, gray alien in a white high-backed cloak. Again, his was white. The surgeons were in black, but his was white. And he told me if I would quit making such a fuss and just go along with them for a little while longer, that I could return to Cydonia, where I was from.
And why did they know you were from Cydonia?
To me, I think it shows the extent of their beguiling and their knowledge of their victims. I had been a big fan of David, still am, of David Flynn and his book, The Secret Chronicles of Cydonia Mars. And had read that book in the past, and was fascinated with it. And I think it's just something they knew, you know, from knowing inside me what would get my attention.
Yeah. Well, what did David Flynn have to say about Mars that was of such import?
For me, it was a couple things. One was I've always had a big connection with the Mississippi Delta. I'm a big blues fan, and I've always felt that I had some connection to there. And in his book, he makes the connection of with it's the whole mirror image of as above, so below, that heaven on earth can actually be pinpointed to the Mississippi Delta region because it coincides with the 30th and 31st parallel with Sedona and the Giza pyramids. It all lines up. And to me, I just went, aha, that's why I've been had my obsession with the Mississippi Delta this whole time, that I've got some connection with Sedona too. And then also, you know, he's big on calculating numbers for things. And at the time he wrote the book, he had the Nephilim as stated as being here for 1,960 years, and I was born in 1960. So I wrote that that was my first birth. And then my second birth was in 1977, where I was saved from my accident, saved from dying. And at the time, I was age 17.5. Well, my favorite number, and I was born at 222. So 17.5 times 2 is 35, and 35 plus 1977 is 2012, which his book focuses a lot on. And 2012 minus 6, which is the letter of number of letters in my name, is 2006, which was my third birth, which is by saying I choose Jesus, my freedom from the demonic possession. So I see three births within my lifetime using numbers like he does. And I think I learned a lot about I really believe that the pyramids on Sidonia are something from the maybe from the Nephilim from before, that perhaps they inhabited the planet back before Rahab, the fifth planet, was destroyed. I just think there's a lot to be said for Mars in a previous civilization. I agree with him a lot in his book about what he has to say about that. And I love the way in his book it's so scientific and philosophical, and looking at Sidonia and the monuments and ancient biblical manuscripts. And then in the end, it's really a call to end times to wake up, and that the Nephilim from old were, it says, you know, they'll be here as they were in the days of Noah, and that they're here again, and that we need to be prepared. And I think they are here. I think that's what happened to me. I think it's that they're part of that realm, whether it's the giants, the demon, earthbound spirits. I kind of get a little bit confused with the difference between the fallen angels and Nephilim and the giants, the earthbound spirits, which are truly doing the handiwork.
Right. Before we end the program, let me just review that very, very quickly, because there's one other question I want to definitely ask you before we end. But since you brought the subject up, there is a difference that many, not all Christians realize, that differentiates the fallen angels and demons. They're all lumped together in one term, but they are all part of Satan Incorporated. As I mentioned or alluded to before, the first group are very good at enticing you, and since they are shapeshifters, as in the fallen angels, can take on many forms, and we found that out from the Ethiopian Book of Enoch. If you go to chapter 19, you'll notice that. But the demons are another whole story, because it has to do with why would there be such a thing as demons if we already have fallen angels? And we know we have fallen angels because they mention as Bene Elohim in the Bible. And Bene Elohim only refers to angels. It does not refer to men. Therefore, when you get to Genesis chapter 6:4, they use the expression Bene Elohim, which revolves around angels, but it was the same Bene Elohim who were the ones that had intercourse with the daughters of men, and the progeny would be the hybrids or the giants. And these giants were only had a certain lifespan. They were cursed to only live for about 500 years, and when they died, their spirits were bound to the earth. And these bound spirits are called the, what we refer to now as familiar spirits, were called the wicked spirits or the unclean spirits that Jesus cast out, as was cited in the New Testament. So we have the spirits that need to inhabit things, i.e. the demons, and we have the fallen angels that can manifest in different forms, take the form of a human being, take the form of an animal, etc., etc., etc. So that's why there's a differentiation that is scripturally backed up, and then, of course, the details of which are brought up in the Book of Enoch. That's why you have the two different dynamics going on here, and that's why usually it's the demons that are the ones that are ready to obsess you once you've opened the doors, and it's the fallen angels who are the ones who are beguiling you and getting you prepared for the obsession and the possession. You see?
Uh-huh. Okay.
So that's basically the way it works, as far as we can tell. Now, my question to you is, on the previous program you had with Georgia Johnson and Kanoi, a question came up about why must we be put through all of this agony? You certainly were put through a tremendous amount of agony starting in the late 70s, ending somewhere in around 2006. But if you had to give an answer to that, I know Kevin Unterberger called in on that particular program. How would you respond to that now? Why you were put through all of this agony?
Well, I think to borrow from something from your book about the necessary fertilizer to test man to their limits, I think it's to rise up to the occasion to be a witness, to testify to the true nature of Jesus Christ and the fact that, yes, the fallen angels are real and they're more powerful than humans, but Jesus Christ, as the Son of God, is more powerful than any of them, all of them put together. And I think that it's that's why I call myself a grateful experiencer, because if it wasn't for these experiences, I wouldn't be able to have the level of faith that I have in the reality of Jesus Christ and his power, and to be able to testify and perhaps help others. I'm hoping to start a small group with the church, maybe for people that have gone through similar experiences. And it's so ironic. It's like having a learning disability that a school doesn't address. You know, why the churches aren't addressing this issue when it's so spiritually related, is just doesn't make any sense. So along with the ideas from the Christian Symposium in July, I would like to try to be a warrior and help other people. So I think I was just put through it to make better of it. I can't be that great of a testifier if I haven't been through the fires, and I've been through it and I've come out the other end, and therefore that's why I refer to myself as a grateful experiencer.
Okay, well, that's an excellent answer, and that is the reason, by the way, why I use that expression in the book, because when I was looking at all of the things that we are put through on this planet, it's almost like a crucible. And the crucible involves pain and suffering. And Jesus never said that we would be absolved from pain and suffering. I don't think you'll find it any place in the Old or New Testament. Matter of fact, we have the book of Job, where even his most faithful servant that didn't do anything wrong was put through things just as a test, because Satan says, he's got it so easy, that Job, but you give him some hard times and the next thing you know, he'll be cursing you. You see? So God said in his infinite wisdom, okay, I'll let you test him, but there's certain parameters that you're going to have to stick by, Satan. Ink. He didn't say ink. I just said that. But, you see, this is what I'm saying, though. So I used that and said, yeah, well, this is how do we grow? We grow through pain and suffering. If this
right.
is a testing ground, this is not the end all. See, many, this is why people are humanistic, secularistic, because they think this is everything. This is the Megillah. Or you have the other group of people in the New Age who feel, I will become my own God, thank you very much, and they use their ego to ease God out. These are the two types of people that you run into constantly who don't want to see the unwanted evidence that Joe Jordan is presenting. I say, well, if God is willing to suffer for us, then the least we can do is be willing to suffer in relationship to what he wants us to do, not in, for what we want to do.
I think I needed to learn a lesson about my curiosity, too, because I flirted too much with people from the dark arts and New Age, where I thought that it was my job to save them and make them Christians. And I think when that door was opened in 1977, just because it was opened, it didn't mean that I had a right to access the evil side of it also. Yeah, you know, I think I had a curiosity that was very detrimental to me, and I had to go through this to learn to not follow through on that curiosity.
Gotcha. And it makes perfect sense to me. And now, we only have about maybe 3 or 4 minutes left, and Zen, do you have any last comments or observations you'd like to make?
Yes, thank you, Byron. I do appreciate it. And I'd like to say that, yes, this is a world of suffering. This is a world of duality. We are learning through the knowledge of good and evil here, and that we will suffer until our Lord comes again to judge the world. And when he banishes all evil and sorrow and pain and suffering, then we will truly have a world of order and harmony and peace and serenity. But, you know, this world is a world, it's proving to us that we cannot do this without our Lord, that we've been given free will to attempt trying all of this, but the Lord is letting us know by giving us this free will that we cannot do it without him, and that at some point it will take him to restore the order and the harmony of this whole universe and the end this age of flesh. And so I thank you, Byron, and everybody for given me the opportunity to be here. And Sheila, I honor you and praise you for speaking up and speaking truth to power and bringing your testimony to light, especially at a time and an age when so many people are fearful to stand on their testimony.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yes, amen. Then, and before I give Sheila the last word, I'm just going to quote Sheila's favorite verse in the New Testament, Luke 10:19-20. It says, and she used this before, I have given you authority to tread upon serpents and scorpions and over all the power of the enemy, and nothing shall hurt you. Nevertheless, do not rejoice in this, that the spirits are subjected to you, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven.
Praise God.
Sheila? Yeah, we have about maybe 2 minutes to go. By my reckoning, so just feel free to say whatever you comes into your heart now.
I just wanted to quote another Bible verse that I got from your book that is very dear to my heart and to this whole experience. It's Romans 8:38-39. I am sure that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor heights, nor depths, nor any other creature will be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. And I just truly believe that, and I thank the Lord for every day for bringing me through this, and I feel his strength that we are protected from now on, and always to be on our guard. And I really appreciate the forum that you and FallenAngels.tv and The Cursed Net offer for people to be able to bring forth their stories and try to help others and be a witness and make it worthwhile. You know, if it can help one person, it makes the trials worthwhile.
Absolutely,
I agree with that. Well, there's the music, Sheila. We certainly are definitely turning into pumpkins at this point. There's nothing except move forward as good Christians and do what we can to try to get people to say, yes, there's only one God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and if you rely on Him, then you will be okay. Okay? Well, thank you very much, Sheila.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
And
thanks, everyone.
And then, yes, have a good night, and to all, have a peaceful night and a fruitful tomorrow. Good night, everybody.